needed some funds, I stopped in New York, and with cooperation from CQ Magazine, the Cowan Publishing, I wrote and published the first DX handbook. It was the Don Miller DX handbook, published by Cowan Publishing, and the money that was made from that funded most of the rest of the de-expedition, along with ACK and funds that were contributed by HAMS. I returned back into the Indian Ocean area, and this were countries like De Roche, Farquhar Islands, the Seychelles and Mauritius area islands, Cocos Keeling Islands, and the Indian Ocean area over the next year.
Now, this is where your controversy with the XCC people and the ARRL started, didn't it?
The controversy occurred, and it was mostly my fault, from two things that happened that I regret very much. And I think I owe an apology to the DX fraternity on a couple of issues. And I think there were a total of 57 countries that were operated from, many of which were new and rare countries, some being ordinary ones. All but, I believe, six of those counted or were legitimate. The controversy came up on two fronts. First of all, when I used to listen to Gus Browning going around on his de-expedition, I used to hear the same high-powered DXers work him night after night, sometimes more than once each night or day, same band. And I vowed that I tried to limit contacts to, you know, I tried to set some operating standards during my expedition, especially on CW, but on both modes. And I tried to limit, and I made it known, that one contact per mode, per band, per station, to give everybody a chance, especially when there's only one of you and your hours are limited. Not everybody observed that. Not everybody was respectful. 99.9% of the DXers are a class act, but there are a few, just like in any group. And I made a list, not a written list, but a mental list of some of these people that were seemed to be abusing the DX, and I wouldn't work them. And as I went along in the expedition, I got, unfortunately, more and more arrogant and more impulsive. And I added people to my mental checklist that I wouldn't work, just call signs. I say people, but of course you don't know the person behind the call sign. You know most of these unless you've met them as a call sign. And one tends to attribute a personality to a call sign. That's something that we could talk about for hours. But I wouldn't work these HAMs. I just wouldn't work them. And I think that was wrong. I'll tell you why later on. But this infuriated a lot of people. There were maybe eventually 20 or 30 people on this list, maybe as many as 40, mostly Americans, a few from other countries. And some of them were in the same DX club in the W2 area. They became enraged, and I can understand that because they're, you know, the DX competition is highly spirited. And at the time, I didn't really realize the impact of what I was doing, but I was determined, and I went on, and I did that, and I regret it. The second thing that happened was that when I got down to the South American area, and I obtained a license to operate at St. Peter and Paul's Rocks from the Brazilian government, a very valid license, and a friend of mine joined me from New England, a fellow named Herb Klein, K1IMP. He joined me in South America, and we were attempting to charter a boat. We had the funds, we had the license, to go to St. Peter and Paul's Rocks. I believe we could have landed there in favorable weather. And one of the reasons we wanted to go there, not only was it a rare country, but some time before that, a German de-expeditioner purportedly went there and worked only 30 HAMs, almost all of them from the same DX club in the W2 area, the same club that I mentioned earlier. And I knew the operation was entirely phony because, first of all, the license from the Brazilian government was not to operate on the island. They had permission only to go to that area, and the ARRL knew that. They had written confirmation from the Brazilian government that they did not have permission to land on the rocks, and it's very doubtful that he was on St. Peter and Paul's Rocks, and that came to light later with verification from the ship captain that they did not, in fact, even land on the rocks. But because of the influence that this DX club had with the ARRL at the time, the ARRL counted these contacts anyway. And when we were just totally unable to get any ship to take us to that area, it was a very dangerous landing. Nobody wanted to attempt it, especially in smaller ships. I made the unfortunate decision that we would go there anyway, and I use the term go there in quotes, and fake the operation. And I tried to justify this on the basis that, well, if the League is going to count an operation that wasn't licensed and wasn't there, that worked only 20 or 30 hams, they certainly should recognize an operation that is properly licensed, whether it's there or not, that works everybody. So Herb and I went to some rocks off the coast of South America and operated as that station. And we didn't tell anybody. We lied about it. And incidentally, I had mentioned to you earlier that I learned that Danny Weil, you know, operated from his boat at many of the places where he signed call signs from. And I had the opportunity to meet Gus Browning in the interim, became pretty good friends with him. And Gus confided in me that he, too, didn't always go to the places where he was. He related one particular part of his expedition in Asia, in the northern India area, Sikkim, Tibet, Nepal, that area, where he just stayed in one place and signed all these different call signs. He told me that personally. So, you know, I'm not trying to justify what I did, but I guess at the time I was trying to justify it in my own mind that, you know, whereas the majority of my operations were legitimate, I tried to justify this in terms of fairness, that if the League was going to count this other operation, they certainly should count mine. And at the time, there was no requirement that you had to provide proof that you were in a particular place or anything. At least we had a valid license. So this further infuriated the few DXers who had worked the German ham, because now they were no longer in an exclusive group. Everybody had an illegitimate contact with St. Peter and Paul's Rocks, not just a few. After that operation, Herb and I went on a very legitimate operation to Navassa Island, which was extremely rare, probably the rarest country at the time. And we went there and operated without a hitch. We had a valid license since it's an American territory, and we had permission. You don't need a visa to go there, but we did get a port clearance in Ponce, Puerto Rico when we left there. And, of course, we were there. We painted our call signs all over the rocks. Navassa Island was a very, very difficult island to land on, very dangerous, and that was a very successful operation. Following that, I completed the places in the Indian Ocean that I wanted to operate at. After the whole thing was over with, the net result was that 6 of the 57 operations were disallowed, and some of them should have been disallowed, okay? I've never discussed a couple of them because my two late deceased expeditioners were involved, and I didn't want to disparage that or them at all.
You were, but, for instance, accused that Maria Teresa was a phony.
There was one island that was disallowed in the Pacific, which was perfectly legitimate, where we were on dry land briefly, and I believe it was one of the reefs that the later disallowed. They said they received a letter from some oceanographic society saying that it was completely underwater. The fact of the matter was that it wasn't. But however, the League was perfectly correct in disallowing a couple of others. Maria Teresa was not a valid operation, and one of the others out there wasn't. And there was a third that was questioned in the Pacific that I think was a valid disqualification.
You must have been very angry with the AR, and they were very angry with you.
Well, I was angry with them because they published an article
in their QEC magazine,
which was unsigned, unauthored, which went too far. And I filed suit against the American Radio Relay League. And I was represented in that lawsuit by a very famous attorney named Melvin Belli from San Francisco. And I went with the attorney to Hartford, Connecticut, Newington, Connecticut, or Hartford, Connecticut, and depositions were taken, and certain things came to light. The case was settled, I don't know for sure, but I believe it was settled for $25,000. And the part of the terms of the settlement is that I was not supposed to reveal the terms of the settlement or the amount of money, and everybody was released from liability. We had sued the League for what we call libel, or which is a form of slander for some of the material that they published about me. And so the net result was those 6 operations were disallowed. Now, there were 3 operations which were disallowed, which I'm still upset enough about, that I'm going to ask, after I make my apologies to the DX fraternity, I'm going to ask the league to reconsider and possibly reinstate them. The first one is Devassa Island. The reason the league disqualified that, the real reason, is because they were upset with me. They said that I wasn't supposed to be there because the United States Navy didn't want anybody on the island. Well, it doesn't matter what the Navy wanted or didn't want. There was no law against being there, and we were there. There's no question in anybody's mind that we were there and that we had a license to be there. So to disqualify a country because they said one branch didn't want us there, without there being any ordinance or law saying we couldn't be there, when in fact the Navy gave us a clearance to go there, and it's in writing, and the league had it.
Excuse the interruption, but it was, of course, not the Navy, it was the Coast Guard.
Well, it's completely uncalled for the league to disqualify that operation. And so even though I agree that some of the operations should be disqualified, that one should not have been. They also disqualified, and I was really shocked to hear this some years later, because I didn't even know, they had disqualified our operation from Heard Island down in the Antarctic area, which is an Australian territory. When I had heard there was a controversy about that, I sent the league a copy of my Australian license, and I sent them a letter from the captain of the ship verifying that we had been there. Somebody said we operated from somewhere else, or the photographs didn't show me in the photographs. Well, I was the only one taking photographs in the first place, and it was dark most of the time I was there. The photographs were not of good quality, but I did show color slides from there, and it was uncalled for that operation to be disqualified. If there was a legitimate question, in fact, the whole controversy in my mind at the time, the whole unfairness of it was that we had, for example, I wanted to go to Bouvet Island, and I was unable to get transportation there. In attempting to get to Bouvet Island, I had written to the captain of the ship which took Gus Browning to Bouvet Island some years earlier. The captain stated that he did not take Gus Browning to Bouvet Island, that Gus operated from the ship. So when I was arguing with the league, I said, why are you disqualifying my operations and allowing all of these other ones, which are completely illegitimate? And why are you disqualifying my legitimate operations along with the others and allowing all these others? And the only thing I could ascertain was that I was just in disfavor with the league at the time, and they were just angry that it was very unfair. And the third place where I was, and it would have been difficult for me to prove because there was something wrong with the operation, but for ham radio purposes it was legitimate, was a place called the Laccadive Islands in the Indian Ocean. We were there. We did have a license. The license could have been questioned, but by the standards at the time, the license we had would have been valid compared to the other licenses which were being accepted for DXCC purposes. So I'm really upset that all of the effort and all of the work that went in to Heard Island, which was a very difficult trip, very rough, the Devassa Island, which was a difficult landing, and the Laccadives trip in the Indian Ocean were disqualified. Those three operations were 100% legitimate. And I've just recovered about 6,000 color slides, and I'm going to go through them. It might even be possible to prove even today, you know, that they were legitimate. But that's well behind us. There have been many expeditions to these places since that time. But the league was correct in disqualifying three or four other operations, which were, you know, my point is that if they disqualified those, they should have disqualified the illegitimate operations that the league knew were illegitimate of the other, the expeditioners as well. I don't want to go back and disparage anybody, or I just would like to legitimize those three very legitimate de-expeditions that we worked so hard for. I think that the good thing that's come out of this is that it's a much fairer and more legitimate hobby today because of what happened. The rules are much clearer. They're much more fairly enforced. They're much better defined. And even though de-expeditioning isn't as adventuresome and exciting as it once was, it's much fairer today. You know, the league is the one that's given us this DXCC competition. You can't really bash them too much because if it wasn't for them, it probably wouldn't be as exciting or as enjoyable as it is.
Well, anyway, Don, was this the point where you decided to quit, to let it be?
Well, in the first place, there weren't very many places left. There weren't very many new countries left at the time, although there would be because politics changed things DXCC-wise. I wanted to get on with my medical career. I was exhausted. I felt an obligation to finish what Chuck and I wanted to do, more or less in his memory, and there was a lot of encouragement from the DX fraternity to do that. I was discouraged by the St. Peter and Paul Rocks thing, not that it was disqualified, but that they allowed the other illegitimate, even more illegitimate operation to survive, and only took action against me, but nobody else. And then the league and some of the people involved imposed upon CQ magazine, they have what they call a DX Hall of Fame, to blackball me from the Hall of Fame. And I see names in there of the expeditioners whose operations were almost entirely illegitimate, you know. I think we set records from four or five different continents for DX contests during the period. And it was so well received by so much of the DX fraternity, particularly thousands of DXers who perhaps run less power and until that time didn't get the opportunity to work too many of these places.
So this was the turning point of the matter around 1968, and in fact it also became a turning point for the rest of your life.
Well, I became very busy with my medical practice, and I determined that I planned to retire at a relatively middle age and get back into it a little more at that time. Marriage and family life were something that were new to me. As a matter of fact, the reason I went to practice in Wisconsin was because a DXer there had mentioned that they needed a doctor in the community. And that's where I met my wife at the time and settled down and eventually moved back to California, where I had been stationed earlier in the Air Force. I had family out here in California. So then the tragedy developed in my life. It ended with me going to prison for 20 years for a crime which hopefully the conviction still will be overturned by the courts. It's being considered at the moment. But I served 20 years in prison for the crime, a crime in which nobody was physically harmed, but in which it was said that I wanted to. And I don't want to get into too many details because it involved my former wife, who, by the way, is just fine. She's remarried. It involved a religious cult in which my son was being involved, my young son at the time, and a lot of emotions, but no physical harm came to anybody. It was something that was brought about by my own fault, due to the same impulsiveness and the same traits that I had that got me into a lot of controversy when I was doing my expeditions. So although I didn't commit the crime, I think much of what happened to me was my own fault. During the time I was in prison, I obtained my law degree and literally fought my way out and have been out for about 6 months now. And I'm living here in California and planning, hopefully, about a year from now to... there is one country, one brand spanking new country. It's been completely overlooked now for some time, and I'm very eager to go there and to a few more places, not modern de-expedition style with helicopters and military vessels and hundreds of thousands of dollars and teams of people, but just on a small boat with a few people, one or two hams, and do it the old-fashioned way and have some fun.
So you make plans for your future, for starting a new life. Anyway, those 20 years in confinement, they must have changed you some way or other.
Well, as you get older, even if you didn't go through what I went through, you always think back about your life and how you would do things differently. It's a natural thing. I have a couple of apologies that I owe. One, for having had a few illegitimate operations and disappointing people. I don't think that should have happened. And second, no matter what. And then not working some DXers, I think was unfair, and if they can accept my apologies at this late point, I'd be grateful for that. But to tell you the truth, I learned a lot about life. I learned a lot about myself. I was on a very narrow course for a long time. I didn't look around me. I didn't really have a chance to learn much about life itself. I learned a lot about ham radio, about geography, about sailing, and about things of that sort. But when it comes to family and some of the more important things in life, I didn't learn about that until it was too late. I learned a lot about myself and about people and about human nature, and I certainly am a different person than I was, but my urge for DX and the expeditions and that sort of thing is still the same.
Isn't it strange that under such conditions you kept your faith in a hobby that has changed during all the years? Was amateur radio really that strong an urge for you to carry on right now?
Let me tell you how strong. I followed DX all these years. I followed every single contest, every single issue of CQ, QST, all the expeditions, watched them. I even kind of moaned when I saw an article in one of the magazines describing the next trip to Navassa Island after hours, which was made by military vessels or helicopters by a big team of people who talked about how their operation was legitimate and as opposed to the previous one, which was ours. And it made me kind of shudder. But I followed this, and I have a deep love for ham radio. I tried to donate some trophies through the ARL, and they wouldn't accept them from me, so I had to use another person to donate those trophies, which I actually paid for the awards that are given out. And I also supported a couple of, when I had the money to do so, I supported a couple of other the expeditions. But by and large, my friends kind of forgot about me.
Well, not all of them forgot you. There was Marty, there was Jim.
I received a visit while I was in prison from Marty Lane, who kind of flattered me by telling me that I was his inspiration. He brought his son to visit me in prison one day, which was quite unexpected. And then some very dear friends of mine from Japan, whom I made friends with when I was in Korea, Jimmy, J-A-1-A-E-A, and his friend Izumi Soma, who was a JA, who's now KH6JA, and a group of them got together when they realized my plight. I should have been released from prison years before I was, by law. But politics, the governor in California doesn't want anybody to parole, and even though they don't have the power to keep people in prison who should parole, they do it anyway. Thousands and thousands of people who should have been released are still in prison, and they're dying in prison. And that probably would have happened to me had not two things occurred. First, obtaining my law degree and fighting the system. And secondly, this group of friends from Japan, these Japanese amateurs whom I worked so hard, you know, to work from these different places in the world at the time and who became friendly with them, and even some newer ones who weren't even around when I was on my expedition. They raised some funds to help me with the court and legal expenses and came to visit me quite often during the last 3 years and provided a tremendous amount of support for me until they finally got me released. You know, they went to see the governor, they did everything possible, and it was so gratifying. I wasn't expecting anything like this. And then there have been a few hams that have written me encouraging letters, sent me cards every Christmas, you know. But I've never lost the love for DX and for the DX fraternity. And I was surprised when I got out. First thing I did is go and take my exams, and I passed the technician license and the general class and the extra class. In fact, they did that all in one night. The funny thing was that when I took these licenses, I would think that they would be surprised, because generally you don't take all three exams in one night. You have to pass one to take the next. But what surprised me was that these examiners just seemed to be in awe that I had no difficulty passing the 5-word-per-minute code test. Well, 5 words a minute, even if you haven't sent CW for 30 or 40 years, you can do in your sleep, of course. You know, we used to think nothing of 15 or 20 words a minute.
By the way, why didn't you get your old call sign?
When I posted a site on QRZ on the Internet, I got an outpouring of email and letters from hams, many of whom thought I was dead, and all kinds of old friends started popping out of the woodwork. My old call sign, W9WNV, was preserved. It's called the Don Miller Fan Club, which is very flattering, by an old friend who now lives in Ohio, W9VNE. It's a club station, and he told me that I could have it back if I wanted it. So I suppose we will eventually have that. At the present time, I'm 86IY, which was assigned to me, you know, a few months ago when I passed my exam.
Well, Don, our time is almost up, and I'm really not authorized by anybody, but let me, just as a member of the ham fraternity, thank you for all the good things you have done. Wish you all the very best for the time to come, and hope that we'll meet again further down the log.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you and the wonderful thing that you and your group are doing. This is quite a worthwhile project, and I'm sure if it's not appreciated now, it will be in time. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to become part of your archives.